Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We've got lots going on today on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're going to be talking about the film Rumi returning in the middle of the program. We're going to be talking about the upcoming event called Growing Up Girl a little later on. Right now, I'd like to welcome Jan Patterson. She is a master gardener and is here to talk to us about the garden fair, which is happening this weekend. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Good to be here.
Nice to have you. So the Santa Fe Master Gardener Association is having a fair at the county fairgrounds on Rodeo Road this Saturday, the 26th of April, from 10 until 4. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But first of all, what is a master gardener as opposed to a gardener?
A master gardener, Mary Charlotte, is somebody who's completed a training course offered through NMSU Cooperative Extension. They graduate from that, then they become an intern for a year and complete 30 volunteer hours in various parts of various activities around the city, and then they become a master gardener. And to continue to be a master gardener, you have to continue to volunteer in community service. So basically, we're a community service organization focused around gardening.
And what do you learn? Do you learn gardening of food, or mostly flowers and landscape and things like that?
It's everything. Our teachers are educators from NMSU or local nurserymen in the city, so we learn about trees, we learn about soils, botany, insects, how to plant, how to grow, how to teach, everything that is connected with gardening, so that when people graduate from the class and go out and talk to people in the community, which is part of our mission, they are basically authorities, if you will, lay authorities in how to garden in Santa Fe responsibly.
So that it is a focus on how to garden specifically in the Southwest, and so of course you have to look first and foremost at the lack of water.
Yes, that's one of the big issues we always talk about. It's not the whole thing in gardening in Santa Fe, but it's a big one, as everybody knows.
Is it possible to have, let's not talk about food for a second, but a nice flower landscape garden without watering it at all?
Probably not. If you want flowers. I mean, there are native plants in Santa Fe that grow, once they're established in the landscape, with just whatever falls from the sky.
And that's I've got a lot of them in my yard. They're called weeds.
Yeah, well, there you are. They're called weeds because you may not want them there, but for other people, they are flowers. So, but to have a real flower garden, you need some supplemental water.
And so what do you learn, how do you teach people to garden with the minimal amount of water? What are some of the basic things that people need to know?
Well, it's kind of like right plants, right place. In fact, one of our presenters this weekend is talking about right plants, right place. It's knowing what the plant's needs are, what they need, what conditions they need to be planted under, and going ahead and doing that. And there's a lot of aspects to gardening, soil preparation, understanding the climate. We were at 7,500 feet, how close we are to the sun, what the different temperatures are in the winter and the summer. And there are plants that love being here. I mean, look at Santa Fe. It's full of really beautiful trees and wonderful wildflowers and native plants. I think it's so exciting to garden here. So we try and pass that enthusiasm on to our students, who then go out into the community and teach. So it's an enthusiasm we teach, as well as the knowledge on how to do it.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the knowledge on how to do it. So in other words, let's say you've got a small area, you want to have a garden in it. What do you do with your soil? How do you deal with this soil, which I think is about, 6 inches of soil and then
of drag.
2 feet of cement?
Yeah, that's about it. Right. Well, we could go back and talk about the principles of xeriscaping, which may be a term that you've heard about. And it's not xeriscaping, it's xeriscaping, which
with
is basically
X.
With an X. It's basically putting plant material in so that it grows with little or supplemental water, or none at all. So we plant in zones up close to your house. You can plant plants that need more supplemental water or water all the time, enriching that soil with soil amendments, adding compost, because there's no organic material in our soil. adding various things to make that a nice growing medium.
There's no organic material in our soil?
It's really nothing. If you had a soil analysis done, you would see there's very little there.
What's there, sand?
Well, it's sand and it's clay and it's what's called caliche, which is that cement layer you were talking about. Doesn't mean there aren't plants that don't like to grow in that, as I've said. But if you want to have a vegetable garden or a really nice flower garden close to your house, you're going to amend your soil and add the materials in the soil that those plants thrive on.
So when you compost, let's say you have a compost heap, which is your eggshells and coffee grinds and orange
right.
peels and those things,
right.
how long does it take for them to turn into actual compost that you can use?
Well, I like to do what's called vermicomposting or worm composting, and I compost all of my kitchen scraps as well as material from my garden. And the worms, the little red worms, just break that down in a season to some really nice friable humus that you can mix into the soil. So, or you can let it break down naturally, which takes a little bit longer. In a season, you can compost things from your garden and from your kitchen.
And so what is the compost? I mean, is it just soil? Is soil another word for, is compost another
yeah.
word for soil?
Well, soil is this sort of amorphous material that we plant in, and it's made up of all kinds of different things in different parts of the world. It's wonderful and rich and organic and fertile, and you just plant right into it. But in Santa Fe, it needs a little help for some of the plants that you want to put in.
And so then you take your compost, which has been broken down by this great service of worms, mm-hmm. and do you put it on top of your flower
blend it in with the native soil. That's what I like to do. And there are different theories on how this works. Some people plant directly into the soil and say, if it wants to grow there, so be it. If it doesn't, it doesn't grow in my garden. Other people will haul in what's called topsoil, which is black and organic, and blend all kinds of things in it. It's all about learning what it is you want to grow, what it wants to grow in, and making that happen. I don't like to work that hard. I do in my vegetable garden, but I don't plant anything that doesn't want to be in my garden. So, you know, I look at these guys and say, hey, we're going to get along. We're going to grow in native soil. Maybe I'll water you for the first couple of years, and then we'll just carry on and be good friends. And you do what you do, I'll do what I do, sort of a thing. So in my containers, I use very rich soil that I make myself. I do a blend of different things and make a nice rich soil, which is easy to do. Or you can buy expensive stuff at a nursery if you
So
want.
You make it yourself out of what?
Well, I start with just basic topsoil, which hasn't got much. You can buy a bag of topsoil. It's just black dirt. It's just clay that's broken up. And I add peat moss and vermiculite and bone meal, primarily those things that I buy separately, and I blend it together, and it's nice, loose soil that annuals in particular like to grow in. The secret to growing just about anything in any soil is how loose and what we use call friable, so that those roots can travel through that soil to get to where they want to go, to stabilize the plant, get the water that comes into them. So
you're really saying friable?
Yeah, friable. F-R-I-A-B-L-E.
I thought you must have said viable.
No, well, I suppose it could be the same thing. But friable means kind of loose and free. It's not solid. It's not compacted. And that's really, I think, one of the most important things in planting anything in soil, is to make sure. You can break up the clay. You can break up Santa Fe soil and still have a tree grow in it, as long as those tree roots can migrate through the soil and reach a stable place, and also have water reach them.
What are the worst plants to grow in Santa Fe? I mean, we've heard it in terms of trees, the tamarisks and the salt cedars seem
right.
like really bad ideas.
Right, and those are invasive species that we're gradually eliminating, that someone brought in thinking, oh, this is great. It likes to grow in this kind of a soil. Obviously, like Russian olive and tamarisk love growing here. Those are mistakes that happen. But I think one of the worst things we can do in Santa Fe is want a green lawn. It's just absolutely not something we should do. And we, as master gardeners, we never promote any kind of a green lawn. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't grasses that don't love being in Santa Fe and give you a green lawn. It's just not Kentucky blue. So again, knowing what wants to grow here with the least amount of water and planting it.
We're talking to Jan Patterson, Master Gardener. So the gardening fair is coming up. The Santa Fe Master Gardeners Association Garden Fair is coming up. It's free. It's from 10 to 4 this afternoon on the fairgrounds. What will you be doing there?
Well, we have, this is the fourth year, by the way, for this fair. It started really small with, I think, 10 exhibitors and 4 speakers. And now we have 10 speakers. These are nurserymen from around the city, as well as educators who are going to talk on a variety of subjects. You can come in and sit and listen to that lecture. We have almost 40 exhibitors in 2 separate halls, and these are nurseries, these are tree growers, these are educators, they're plant societies. The Master Gardeners are going to have 2 booths, one with demonstrations and one where you can come and ask a question or bring something from your garden that's looking bad and find out what it is and what to do about it. We're going to have a plant sale of native plants and drought and hardy plants and perennials and annuals. This is a great place to pick up some real bargains. We're going to have a flea market with where you can pick up some used tools and decorations for your garden and pots and composters and gloves and all kinds of things. We're going to have a labyrinth that people can walk if you care to meditate during this affair. We're going to have a gardening activity center for the children to come so the kids can come and have a good time. We have food service. Cowgirl's going to cater our food, so come, you know, come for the fair and stay for lunch or something like that. So we're going to have a free resource guide that we're going to give to everybody that has tips on how to garden in Santa Fe and websites and different things like that. So there's an awful lot going on all day. The parking is free. Come at 10 o'clock for the first presenter. They run all day, every hour, until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So there's just a lot of things for people to do.
Now, do you feel like before we're talking about how you say to your plants, you know, you do your thing and I'll do mine. Do you end up feeling like you have kind of a relationship with your plants?
Absolutely. A couple of years ago when the bark beetles came through, you know, it was just like people were out there actually praying and talking to the trees, come on, pull through, we can do this, we can do this. And I lost only 2 trees out of nearly 100. So I guess if prayer works, maybe that's a good example.
So you were out there praying to...
Absolutely, talking to my trees. I just love every single thing that grows.
Do they talk back to you?
Oh, they grow. We have a language. I actually have a CD that is somebody recorded, and it's the sound of the bark beetles inside a pinon.
Yeah, we had David Dunn on the air talking about that.
Yeah, I know. It was really kind of devastating to hear that munching going on. So it's basically just out there saying, come on, we can pull through this, and it really worked. So not everything survives. You're not a real gardener until you kill or allow a lot of plants to not survive. Not everything makes it in the garden, and that's what's so capricious and so exciting and fun about it.
I'm a terrible outdoor gardener, although my indoor plants do fine. What is it? Is it like a gift?
Well, I think it's a passion, and that's one of the fun things about being a master gardener is we're all crazy, and we sit around, we talk about soil and amendments and nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium and trees and things like that. It's just something that that people get passionate about and want to get better and better and better at it and realize that it's a relationship that we have, or at least I have, with the plants that want to grow in my garden. You know, we just... I have no control over it, really. They're in the driver's seat, but it's wonderful to be out there and to see, plant some seeds and see something grow up and then put it on the table in a salad bowl. You know, it's very thrilling to me.
The Master Gardeners program, as you said, has a community service aspect to it. What kind of community service do you and the other Master Gardeners do?
We function in 2 ways. We have our training class that runs for 16 weeks every year, and we graduate close to 50 people from that, and then they become our volunteers. So what we want to be is to promote responsible gardening in Santa Fe. So we have a hotline that people can call into 7 days a week if they want. We staff it on Wednesdays and Saturdays, so we help people solve problems in their garden. We have information booths at the Audubon Center. We have an information booth at the Farmers Market and at Santa Fe Greenhouses and at El Dorado Flea Market. So people can come, ask questions, bring specimens in, and get supported on how to solve problems in their garden.
Do you find that you also get involved in herbalism? Is that part of your passion?
We have an herb garden at the fairgrounds. We have a small herb garden that we maintain, that we teach out of. We have a small greenhouse there that we grow plants in, and we have workshops there. We have a demonstration garden there that people can come and look and see what grows with virtually no supplemental water. We have three exciting new projects this year. We're going to be at the Rail Yard Garden when that opens and groom some gardens there. We are setting up in El Dorado a water demonstration garden where people can come, know what to do with the water that falls from the sky, how to capture it, which is one of our missions, is to let no water go where it doesn't want to go or shouldn't go. And we also...
Where should water not go?
Down the road, into the sewer.
Onto pavement.
Onto pavement, absolutely. So a lot of our mission is to teach people how to capture runoff from the top of their houses and keep it on their property. So
I have heard, and actually done an interview with somebody about that even in places like Santa Fe and Tucson and Phoenix, you can have an incredible garden with only the water that falls from the sky, which is the... 12 inches a year, but that adds up if your roof is big enough.
Well, because it's hard surface and it runs off, it's amazing what water you can capture from your roof. And there's a lot of ways of doing that. You know, the canales, there's lots of different ways. Actually, one of our presenters is Jim Brooks, and he's an absolute expert on, we had two presenters actually, on harvesting rainwater, that people can come and listen to the lectures, and then those guys are going to stick around and they can ask questions of if they want to. There's so many techniques. We could spend hours just talking about how to do that. So I recommend if people are interested in how to harvest rainwater from their rooftop, how to keep it on their land and use it to irrigate their plant material, to come to these two lectures on Saturday.
And what is the number for more information if people want to find out more about the Santa Fe Garden Master Gardeners Garden Fair?
I'll give my number, 982-6111. People can call me if they have any questions that they want to find out what's going on. Our website is www.sfmga, Santa Fe Master Garden Association, .org. And everything that I can tell you about the fair is on that website. So if you have online access, you can get everything you need to know right there as well.
And there's also a hotline number.
There's a hotline, right? Mm-hmm.
What's that?
471-6251. People can call in and leave a question for people, and we'll call you back. Or you can go on the website, and there's a banner. Ask a Master Gardener. Click on that. Ask your question, and somebody will get back to you online. So we have various ways for people to solve their problems.
Well, Jan Patterson is a Master Gardener, and the Master Gardener's Garden Fair is this Saturday, April 26th, from 10 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon at the County Fairgrounds on Rodeo Road here in Santa Fe. Thank you, Jan, so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the movie Rumi Returning. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Kel Kearns and Cynthia Lucas. They're the filmmakers who made the film Rumi Returning, which screens this weekend at the Santa Fe Film Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. So Rumi Returning. Rumi is a poet who lived 800 years ago and is well known by probably many people in Santa Fe. But who was Rumi?
Well, first of all, we just we got in about midnight last night from Fez, Morocco, where Rumi Returning screened at an international Sufi festival for people all over the world. And one thing we can definitely say that about Jalaluddin Rumi is that he's universally loved all around the planet. It was another packed house, which is what we've seen for this film everywhere that it's screened, including the Santa Fe Film Festival. I think history-wise, Cynthia, do you want to, can we encapsulate his in a few sentences?
Sure. Well, at the very opening of Rumi Returning, the great mystical scholar of our day, Andrew Harvey, who is a Rumi expert, makes this statement about Rumi. Rumi combines the philosophical greatness of a Plato with the spiritual realization of a Jesus or a Buddha with the literary gifts of a Shakespeare. So Rumi was a 13th century mystic who combined these three wonderful qualities of philosophy, spiritual realization, and literary greatness. And because of his literary greatness, he's been able to speak to people about the whole process of uniting with the divine and discovering the sacred in the everyday, and how his greatest message we found, and what really resonates with people all around the world, such as in Fez, Morocco, and Prague, Czech Republic, where we had a European premiere, and Monterrey, Mexico, for the Universal Forum of Cultures. What really resonates with everyone is his message of universal tolerance and peace. And he sees the oneness of humanity, and this is the message that we believe is so relevant today and why there's such a renaissance of interest in this 800-year-old mystic.
I think it's so interesting that he was a religious figure, a teacher, and then he was a married man with children and so on, and then he met this man who was his great love in life and was totally transformed. And it's perhaps hard for people to even understand that, because it's beyond a romantic relationship.
Well, it's absolutely beyond romantic relationship, beyond words. You're talking about Shams of Tabriz, who Rumi met in his late 30s. And as you indicated, Rumi was well thought of, was renowned as a scholar and an academic and a teacher. He had taken over his father's task of the madrasa in Konya, Turkey, when his father died. Very, very knowledgeable. You know, this was during the period that was known as the Golden Age of Sufism, and it was during the medieval time when the West had lost much of the classical knowledge of the ancient world, and it was retained by these great philosophers and thinkers and scientists, of whom Rumi was one. But Shams is an amazing figure. Shams was a poor dervish, wandering dervish, who came to Konya knowing that he needed to meet the famous Jalal ad-Din Rumi. And upon their meeting, I guess it literally transformed both of their lives. And when I say that may be romantic in the highest sense of being romantic, but they really went beyond words, they went beyond self, they began to identify within each other the divine one. They began to see no separation between themselves, and in a way they work as those two mystics, great mystics, work as a model for the world itself, that within each other we see the beloved with a capital B being the one unitive, divine, loving source in the cosmos. And then from that, everything changes. The outlook on all of life, your outlook toward ecstasy and bliss and the achievement of it. But it's losing oneself and the annihilation of the self in the other. And in that other, you find the divine.
I think it's really interesting that it seems to, knowing as little about Rumi as I do, but it seems like there's a real movement from a kind of scripture-based religion to a very much more of an experiential kind of spirituality.
Yes, he certainly lived what you're saying, the more experiential type of spirituality, which, by the way, he discovered that path to a large degree as a result of his own father, who lived that kind of spirituality, very experiential, very sensual, very much lovers of nature, really all of creation. Everywhere you turn, you see the face of God is a beautiful quote from the Quran, and they truly lived that in their lives. And Mevlana Jalal ad-Din Rumi, as a young boy, received that wonderful gift from his father, that way of spirituality, that path that is experiential and not just textual and theoretical. Although he had all of that knowledge, he had the knowledge base, he was very learned, Rumi was, he still lived his philosophy and his spirituality. to prime, the fullest.
A prime example of that is that as Shams really became Rumi's guru, master, he encouraged him to throw his father's books away. And, you know, you see that sort of scenario in Zen Buddhism and other spiritual paths that reach a high degree of consciousness. But that's not to say also that Rumi was not deeply steeped in Islamic knowledge and knowledge of the Quran, which he certainly was. And that was really the wellspring out of which his universal mysticism came.
Well, as you emphasize on the film, is the... The Islamic emphasis on knowledge is huge, and the word for knowledge is second only to the word for God in the Quran.
That's correct. Ilm is so very, very important, as our expert commentator, the chair of Islamic studies at American University, Dr. Akbar Ahmed, says in Rumi Returning, ilm is the second most quoted word in the Quran after the name of Allah. And so it's throughout the Quran, and the Prophet Muhammad said many times that the pursuit of knowledge was very important. In fact, the most important thing for Muslims to attain, and they should even go as far as China to attain that knowledge, which at that time would have been as if we were going to the moon, you know, to attain knowledge. And so he was emphasizing that that knowledge was even more sacred than the ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr, Muhammad said. So it's quite a tradition, Islamic tradition, the pursuit of knowledge. It's very, very sacred to them.
So we're living in an age where many Americans associate Islam with jihad and extremism and so on. Do you feel that Rumi has a role to play in the, mitigation of some of the prejudices that we carry?
Well, you know, I would say, Mary, that is the, most definitively the reason that we made the film. We felt like that earlier versions of Rumi on film in this country, in America, had tended to uproot him from his Islamic foundations. And there were, we've watched one documentary on Rumi where they get all the way through the documentary without mentioning that he was Muslim. So we think that it's ultimately important. So, we're really seeing this upswell of Sufism and universal mysticism within the path of Islam that seems to be a real response on the vast, vast majority of Muslims to reclaim the words of Muhammad and reclaim their own tradition and to reassert the basic tolerance and love and empathy and passion for the divine that really is at the heart of Islam. So I guess we had two purposes. Number one was to help Muslims that are trying to exert this so-called moderate voice. Moderate is kind of a strange word for what it is, but to provide them with a hero, with someone that they can claim and that they can show to others as an example of the true heart of Islam. Rumi has been called the light in the eye of the Prophet. And so it's that sort of feeling that we were trying to give to our Muslim audiences. But then on the other hand, for the West, we really wanted to shatter this illusion that this tiny, tiny minority of violent terrorists have given to the Islamic faith, which is just, you know, if any, I'm sure a lot of your audience has traveled in the Muslim world, it just has nothing to do with the heart of people who call themselves Muslims.
The film Rumi Returning screens on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Santa Fe Film Center at 8:15 in the evening, Sunday at 12:15 as well, and then also on Tuesday and Thursday of next week. Kel Kearns and Cynthia Lucas, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about Growing Up Girl. Please stay tuned. I'd like to welcome now Barbara Beasley Murphy. She's the president of Penn New Mexico, and Michelle Sewell, who is joining us by phone. She's a writer, poet, and editor of the book Growing Up Girl, an anthology of voices from marginalized spaces, and Maureen Burdock, who is a graphic novelist. Welcome, ladies, to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hey, thank you.
How are you doing?
Good, good. It's great to have all of you on the phone. And we are here to talk about an event that's happening this weekend, April 25th and 26th, sponsored by Penn New Mexico on young women in young adult literature. It's in collaboration with the O'Keefe Arts and Leadership Program for Girls. This is based on an anthology of yours, Michelle Sewell. Tell us about the making of this anthology, Growing Up Girl, an anthology of voices from marginalized spaces.
Right. Back in 2004, I decided to quit my good paying day job to become a full-time writer. And part of that was teaching workshops to women and girls in marginalized spaces, detention centers, group homes, domestic violence shelters, alternative schools, and encouraging them to tell their stories. What I discovered, these women and these girls were bursting with not only stories of what they were sort of struggling with, but they were just great writers. And during that process, I said, wouldn't it be great to put this book together? But I was struggling, you know, making ends meet. And then in 2006, I received a grant from my local art council here in Maryland. And they gave me the seed money to start the project of Growing Up Girl. And to augment the work I already had, I did a national call that turned into an international call for women and girls to write about what it meant to grow up girl. They could take the snapshot any time in their life that they wanted to and tell us about what it meant to be a girl in that time frame. And we came up with 93 contributors, and the work is just powerful and just awe-inspiring. It's amazing, amazing work. I'm so proud of that book.
Now, did you have mostly young authors in it? Are there girls in it, or is it mostly women looking back on their girlhood?
It's the writers are from the age of 14 to 60, so we have a good span of people in the book. We have first-time writers, we have freshmen, freshman high school writers, we have 60-year-old writers, so it's women and girls across the time for them.
And what are some of the themes that come up over and over again people dealing with their girlhood?
You know what, the thing that came for me a lot was that it's not always safe to be a girl child, that they really struggled with fending off people. They struggled with making good decisions. They struggled with being okay with the body that they were born into and recreating a personality or understanding of who they were. It was really the theme of, I'm trying to be safe for a lot of the writers, for a good number of the writers. It was about creating a safe space for them to be who they were.
Have you seen any changes in that sense of safety, or is it just the business as usual in terms of the threats to girls, now compared to, let's say, 20, 30 years ago?
Right. The second book that just came out 2 weeks ago called Just Like a Girl, is a follow-up to Growing Up Girl. And we wanted to hear from girls about the ways that they save themselves, about the ways that they're superheroes for themselves. And the stories are, they start out like, this thing happened to me, but then I use my wit, or I use my humor, or I use my smarts to get myself out of the situation. And so I think if you got a copy of Growing Up Girl and then got it Just Like a Girl, you could see the transformation. The girls understand that they don't have to wait around for somebody to save them, that they have all the skills, they have all the passion, they have all the understanding to save themselves. So I do think girls and women have the capacity to do that. We've survived over time with that evidence. So yes, absolutely.
So the theme, one of the themes this weekend is young adult literature and how young women are represented in young adult literature. Do you find that there's a lot of good books for girls with which they can identify and be that they can be empowered by?
You know, I think I was thinking about that as I was thinking about my speech for Friday. And, when I was growing up, I used to read the Sweet Valley High books. I don't even know if they make them anymore. And they used to, it was about twins, and they were in high school, and sort of all the things they went through. And always the events were these garden variety things, like which boy is going to the prom, or, her father doesn't want her to stay out, late for curfew. Like, those are the issues they were struggling with. And then recently, I have nieces now, And I picked up one of the books they were reading, and they're talking about teen pregnancy and cutting and, you know, running away from home and living on the street. So I think the books really have transitioned to reflect who girls are. You know, when I was growing up, Dear God, It's Me, Margaret by Judy Blume. Loved that book. And that's how we discovered about periods and breasts and all these things that our parents weren't necessarily talking to us about. So I think she was a trailblazer in that regard, too. So, but the books that are being, you know, produced now definitely speak to the harder time and the more complex ways that girls are growing up.
We're talking to Michelle Sewell. She's going to be the keynote speaker at the event Growing Up Girl, which is this weekend. Stay with us. Let's turn right now to Barbara Beasley Murphy. You're the president of Penn, New Mexico, and you've written a book called Life, How I Love You, Lily Finds Frida in the Museum of Fine Arts. This is would you call this a young adult novel?
I would call it a young adult novel, although it can be read by children 10 years old and up. And it is for people particularly who come to our museums, and we want them to discover that the museums belong to them and that you can be transformed in a museum. I think because they are places of passion, and there are so many more museums in the United States than there were a few years ago, and often I think the children feel they're not allowed there, or the young readers.
They're certainly not allowed to touch anything.
They're not allowed to touch anything in some of them. There are touch museums. But Lily, in this story, is taken to the museum because she's being punished for sticking an alarm clock in the organ while her sister is playing at church, singing at church. Turns out that her sister is really sick and dying of leukemia. And it's a kind of rebellion that she's having, because it's a very, very difficult time. She's private, and yet the museum is a public place that nourishes her. And she sees the painting of Frida Kahlo, who's painted herself at about the same age Lily is, and the painting speaks to her. Frida Kahlo speaks to her, and Lily is an artist. And so, in a way, it frees her to express the anguish, the anger, the fear, and also the delight in life that she feels, that all people feel, no matter if you are losing somebody, you still can be happy.
It's you take on a pretty heavy theme, and I wondered if your intention was to also help young people who are going through the process of losing a relative.
It definitely is, I think, and because dealing with death is human, no matter what age you are. And so the Leukemia Society has taken the book over for families who are going through this, because often the other children are sort of left out while the parents are focusing so on the ill child. Yeah.
How did you get into the voice of that first-person singular 12-year-old?
Well, I don't know. I think I have a very sharp ear, and that's maybe one of my gifts as a writer. I can hear all kinds of different people in my head. And then I sort of see a movie in my mind, and that's how I begin to write. This is the first book I've ever written in present tense, to give it an urgency.
And that sort of child living in the present sensibility.
Yes, that's right. I think so.
So let's turn to Maureen Burdock. You have written a graphic novel about the disappeared women of Juarez. And as you say at the beginning, you haven't actually been to Juarez. What was your inspiration?
Well, I've been to Juarez now. So I actually, it all began when I went to Denise Chavez's Border Book Festival 2 years ago. And I was doing some street art. I was drawing on the sidewalk. I was drawing in chalk a life-size Guadalupe. And this group of amazing artists from Juarez, this group of young men, was standing around me watching me, and it turned out they have a gallery in Juarez, and they asked me to do a show there. And so I became friends with them, and they're really incredible comic book artists, and I, in the process of figuring out what to write about and what to draw about, I had heard about this issue of the disappeared women. And I decided to do a whole series of graphic novels based on female heroines who deal with such issues. And the first one was this superheroine I created out of one of the disappeared women who actually had lived in Juarez.
And so part of what they do is they go out and they actually save women who've been taken away. And it has a real sort of Superman feel to it, even though it's Superwoman.
Right. Yeah, that's the idea, is really, I wanted to make art that would empower women and empower the community there, and also bring, you know, hopefully in a positive way, bring some humor to the situation that people can use to transmute this incredibly horrific thing that they've been faced with there.
So it's in English and Spanish. Is this being distributed in Juarez?
I sold some copies of the book there, and there was some publicity there, and it was also my partner Cindy and I had the opportunity to read the book out loud to a group of about 30 maquilladoras there, and actually have a conversation with people there about what was going on.
What was that like?
It was really incredible. To me, that's the best of what art and literature can do, really open some doors to communication that way and cross borders that way.
Let's turn back to Michelle Sewell, who is joining us by telephone. Tell us about Girl Child Press.
Girl Child Press came about, because Growing Up Girl came about. I hadn't really planned to do an anthology into the large span that I did. And when I saw that it was heading towards a national sort of distribution, I decided to sort of formalize the experience. And the term girl child is sort of a term that I grew up with. I'm originally from Jamaica, Kingston, Jamaica. And they called little girls girl children. And it was sort of an endearment. And so I wanted something that endeared us girls and women, and to reframe them in these ways that they don't always feel treasured or valuable. And so I named it Girl Child.
So you are doing things like workshops and open mics and writing experiences for girls to let them really express themselves. In what contexts are you doing those now? Tell us about that work.
Right now we're doing two things. One, we go into group homes. There are, you know, tons of kids living in out-of-home placements. And I, along with some of the contributors of Growing Up Girl, we go to these group homes and offer free workshops to the girls and the staff there and invite them to write memoirs about themselves, where they are now, where they want to be. We do activities about rewriting your family life so you're not a victim to your history, that you can rewrite history at any time that you want. And just to encourage them that writing and telling their truth is one of the most powerful things they can do, that they're not held hostage to what people say about them, what people think about them. They can write themselves into their own history. The other thing we're doing is working with women who are in recovery, also doing memoir writing. And, you know, when people have really struggled with addiction, they've told lots of lies, they've destroyed lots of relationships. And this is a way to mend those things and to tell those stories that maybe they couldn't tell while they were wrapped in their addiction. So those are the two major projects that we're working on right now.
Barbara Beasley Murphy, tell us more about the event that's happening this weekend. So it's Friday and Saturday. Michelle Sewell, whom we're talking to, is going to be giving a keynote address on Friday evening at the O'Keefe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. And then what's happening on Saturday?
On Saturday, it's going to be very, very special because that is when the young people, the young women that we have invited to be part of Growing Up Girl, are going to be involved. Maureen is going to teach a workshop at La Fonda Hotel, which gave us the room in appreciation for what we are doing for girls in Santa Fe. And in the afternoon, we will have a panel discussion. And there will be two girls from the Indian school in Santa Fe and a girl who goes to Monte del Sol Charter School and a girl from the Albuquerque Academy who works for her school newspaper. four sensational, I really should call them women, because they are incredibly great. They know what they're up for, and they are great talkers. So there's going to be a discussion led by a moderator, and then there will be Michelle Sewell and others. I'm going to be on it, and Maureen's going to be on
the panel. And author Kate Buckley,
who wrote that wonderful book, Choices. And I think we're going to have a very hot discussion. It's going to be at the annex of the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum.
So that's in the afternoon from 1 to 3.
From 1 to 3.
And then the morning part is from 9:30 to 11:30.
That's right.
With ice cream. At LaFon. With ice cream. There, ladies
all,
and gentlemen.
All girls and women like ice cream.
Now, the inspiration for this was Michelle's anthology, but then I read somewhere that you were also doing, in the interest of equal time, a boy event next year or next fall?
Definitely. We want to do a boys' event. Penn, New Mexico, really cares about writing and writers and believes it's maybe the essential thing about human beings is the word. So we want to get the word out for what today's girls need and what today's boys need. We know that they're growing up early and that there's a lot of stuff that goes on that's hard to deal with. And we want them to be able to talk about it, write about it, and tell others about it.
Michelle, in the work that you're doing, do you face the issue of young women and girls who are born into a world that seems to be on the verge of collapse? I mean, do you find them dealing with that emotionally and in their writing?
Absolutely. In talking to the girls that we deal with in the memoir writing workshop, they often feel out of control, like, what choices should I make? They feel tugged at. And then whatever family dynamics that are going on that they don't have control of, they're telling them that this is a generation that can have anything and do anything, and they don't feel like they really have access in meaningful ways. And they talk about that a lot. The girls are really articulate about how they feel sort of put upon to make decisions, but they don't feel like they have the right sort of tools and skills to make the decision that works for them.
What about the environmental realities around them, global warming and so on? Is that stuff real to them?
No. You know, I'm not going to say globally now, but the girls that I deal with, you know, the issues dealing with, that's what's paramount. You know, they're talking about how they're going to make it through, you know, to the ninth grade. They're talking about, is there going to be enough money in the home? They're talking about, is mom and dad going to stay together? I mean, they're not necessarily thinking about global warming or the 12-year-old in Africa. They really are sort of focused on the life they're living. And I feel like sometimes they don't have the luxury to worry about somebody else because they're so, you know, fixated on worrying about themselves.
I think it was so interesting what you said a few minutes ago, is that they are telling their own stories and how empowering it is and how important it is to have a narrative about your life. I got a call from a friend not too long ago who's in her 60s and her life is changing. And she said, you know, the problem with my life now is I do not have a coherent narrative to describe it. And I thought that was such an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I encourage the girls to journal because what they think is, you know, absolute collapse today, they're going to read their journal a month from now and might even laugh at themselves like, okay, it wasn't that deep. So I encourage the girls I journal every day. I encourage them to journal to keep that history going because, you know, we often reframe things to make it more or less. And if you have a journal where you're honest in the journal, you can read and say, okay, this is where I was. This is where I am. Maybe this is where I really am still struggling, or this is where I'm shining. And it's your own sort of archive that you keep on yourself.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here. Michelle Sewell is a writer and poet and has put together this wonderful anthology, Growing Up Girl, an anthology of voices from marginalized spaces. Barbara Beasley Murphy is an author and the president of Penn, New Mexico. And Maureen Burdock is an artist and graphic novelist. And all of them will be involved in the Growing Up Girl program this weekend, Friday and Saturday, sponsored by Penn, New Mexico, in collaboration with the O'Keeffe Arts and Leadership Program for Young Girls. And if you would like to RSVP or find out more information, you can call 988-5185. Thank you so much, ladies, for being with us.
Thank you.
It was great.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Mose Allison. No, that's tomorrow. Good Morning Jazz Today features Bill Smith's Concerto for Clarinet and Jazz Combo. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Be happy. We will see you tomorrow. Bye.